This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 233 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I should have been prepared for it, but I wasn't prepared for it. On Wednesday, I went to Twitter and I tweeted out my top 10 running backs and wide receivers based on what my projections are saying. Now, as I said in the tweet, I emerged from my mom's basement with finished projections, so I decided to share what those projections said. And as is usually the case, I got crushed. One person was mad at me that both Vikings receivers weren't in the top 10. Now, I can understand that to a degree, I guess, and the projections currently have them as top 15 wideouts, so it's not like they're far off. Another account quote-tweeted the list and said that I was part of the national media who seemed to underrate T.Y. Hilton. T.Y. Hilton, for what it's worth, is the wide receiver 11. But here's where it got weird. There was also a group of Packers fans who were relentlessly hitting my mentions about Aaron Jones. And it was because Aaron Jones liked my tweet, so people saw it. And somehow, of all the players in the NFL, people were calling me an Aaron Jones hater. What a world we live in. One thing I noted when I tweeted what the projections spit out was that those projections are not my rankings. And that confused people a bit. I actually got an email from Eric W. that I think brought up a very valid question. It said, "You posted some projections and said these weren't rankings. For draft and analysis purposes, are we better off using the projections alone without any human bias? People talk about how we overestimate our ability to predict things, especially in fantasy. Are we better off just simply taking the projections data and basing decisions and rankings off that, or are you adjusting ranks based on upside or other soft factors that I would argue might not actually be beneficial?" So let me explain why I don't view projections and rankings as the same thing. Making projections can be done in a lot of different ways. The way I create them is through what I guess I would call a top-down approach. Based on a good number of inputs, I get team information. So the number of plays a team will run, the number of passes, the number of rush attempts, those types of data points. Once those are locked in, all of the player projections feed into those team projections. That way you're not just creating projections without any sort of context. It's all fitting together within what that team is actually going to do. This is why rushing share and target share then becomes important. You can take the rushing and passing volume and then split up rushing attempts and targets based on market share. To get those rushing and target share numbers, there will be some form of subjectivity. Like, we know certain stats are sticky year over year, and we can find trends based on historical data. It's not like we're just throwing random target share numbers out there that have no backbone. But there's still some guesswork being done, and that's why it's a projection. It's not called a certainty. For me personally, the process of building out projections each season isn't necessarily to get a list of players to draft from, because my projections are going to be wrong, just like my rankings are going to be wrong. I hope they're more right than what others are working off of, but it would be foolish for me to think that there's zero variance with the projections that I build. Not only that, but projections are a mean outcome. They're what would be expected to happen. At the end of Eric's email, he says, "Or are you adjusting ranks based on, quote, upside or other soft factors that I would argue might not actually be beneficial?" So with something like upside, which gets thrown around a lot, I actually think it does matter. It matters quite a bit. What upside is basically telling us is a player's realistic maximum ceiling. And when we're projecting something, we're only getting a player's realistic average. And when we're looking at how many points a player is going to score across a season, that floor and ceiling equation matters. And let's not confuse this with how a player is scoring those points in a given week. Like, you most definitely can argue that Tyreek Hill's up and down scoring last season didn't actually matter, given what he did during his good weeks. But when entering a season, the floor and ceiling equation is different. You're talking about how many points these players are going to end up scoring, not how they're scoring them. And with some players, there's more certainty. We're certain that DeAndre Hopkins is going to see a large target share and be productive. We're certain that Ezekiel Elliott and Saquon Barkley will have massive workloads. There's less certainty for Le'Veon Bell and Antonio Brown. They're on completely new teams. That means their range of outcomes shifts because we know less about their situation. It could mean that they have more upside due to ambiguity, but it could also mean that they have a much lower floor. So my projections will look at the average outcome. They'll say, this is what the expectation is for Antonio Brown this season. But I may look at that and say, I know that the wide receiver position is deep through round four, so if I spend an early round pick on Antonio Brown, I can strive more for ceiling because there are solid backup plans. I actually think this is even more true when you look at lower tiered players. Like, the difference between how I rank my top 20 at each position isn't going to be drastically different than the way that you do. What's different is how we approach the later rounds. And I'm not talking about draft strategy. I'm talking about who we pick. Because in the middle and the late rounds, you really should be striving for upside. But how I view a player's path to upside may be drastically different than the way that you do. As it pertains to projections, though, a projection isn't going to use its imagination like your own brain will. A projection last season wasn't going to tell you to draft James Conner. But we know that there were other circumstances that may have led you to getting James Conner. We knew there was at least some chance that Le'Veon Bell wouldn't play for at least a game or two. So you may have bumped Conner up in your rankings while your projection remained the same, because you're looking more at upside and you're telling yourself a story to that upside. And that story isn't captured in a projection. That's why rankings and projections don't have to match. And that's why the two shouldn't match. Before getting into more questions this week, I wanted to send another reminder about FanDuel's Mega Eagle Contest. Golf's biggest weekend is coming up, and the Mega Eagle is a contest with $1 million in prizes. And what's cool about the contest is that if Tiger Woods ends up winning, you get your entry fee back. You don't even need Tiger in your lineup to get your money back. For more info on the Mega Eagle, visit FanDuel.com or download the app today. Eligibility restrictions apply. This first question is from @RossVerba. What's the best ratio of film and metric when analyzing players? I don't think there's one single answer for this. And really, my answer is that there shouldn't be some strict ratio. You should focus on what you're best at analyzing. Like, I know that my prospect model is pretty successful and that I can understand the game of fantasy football better through numbers. So let's just say that I go with an 80-20 ratio between numbers and film, whatever that actually means. It wouldn't make much sense for me to then go to some 50-50 split if I know that I'm finding success through doing something I know I'm better at doing. Just like it wouldn't make sense for someone who's great at grinding film to all of a sudden be focusing a lot more on analytics. The two have to work together, though. I'll say that much. This next question is from @FFPollTsunami. How do you treat this year's rookie draft? Do you use your firsts to trade for unknown assets, or do you love this year's rookie picks? I have the 104 for context. As is usually the case, it depends on your situation, but I'll brain vomit some thoughts about this class and rookie pick valuation this season. So first off, I think from strictly a talent standpoint, this class is very flat at both running back and wide receiver, meaning there aren't many obvious standouts. The wide receiver class is pretty strong though. Not a huge fan of the running back class, but the wideout class is good. That would intuitively mean that I'm a big fan of trading back in order to get more picks within this class. If it's deep but not top-heavy, that would make sense. But I will say, I think a lot of people are viewing it the way that I do. And once the NFL draft is over, we're going to have more clarity. And that means that there's a chance that we also see more clarity with the top-end choices at receiver and running back in our rookie drafts. So basically what I'm saying is, if you can get early picks at a discount, I'm fine with doing that. But if your league mates aren't budging, they seem to value the picks as they usually would, trading back isn't a bad idea, because there's a lot of depth in this class, especially at wide receiver. This next question is from @DBFeld. When approaching drafts for next season in redraft leagues, what's the best learning you can take from last season to apply to your draft strategy this year? So I don't know if there's one single thing that I took away from last year that I'll apply this year. I think being patient with running backs is important, though. We saw that a lot last year with Kerryon Johnson, Aaron Jones, and Nick Chubb. While I don't believe that talent matters a whole lot in terms of making an impact at running back in real football, I do think that coaches should strive to think rationally. And thinking rationally means playing the most talented running back. But I'd also say the main takeaways I generally have in fantasy football end up being related to how the market reacts the following year. And it's usually based on overstating things that happen in a single year sample. So I'd watch out for situations like that as we get into the summer months and start drafting more teams. This next question is from @AnnoyingStatGuy. Now that the dust is beginning to settle, would love an update / some analysis on Nick Chubb's fantasy value moving forward, given how much the roster has changed since the end of last season. Yeah, so when I sent the tweet about my top 10 running backs and receivers, or what my projections said, Nick Chubb wasn't on the list. And there was a little bit of backlash from that. When Kareem Hunt signed with Cleveland, I sort of figured that more people would assume that he was going to play a big role. But it seems like they don't think that. After the 8-game suspension is over, I would be shocked if Kareem Hunt has absolutely zero role in that offense. At the very least, he's probably going to dig into Nick Chubb's rushing work, and I'm a little bit more concerned about the receiving work. Chubb didn't have that significant of a role in the passing game last year, and now there are more weapons in that Browns offense. So if another running back is taking some work from him, That's not a good thing. But where I'm at on his redraft value is that I think his ADP is actually fine. A projection won't necessarily capture what Nick Chubb is going to be as a fantasy asset this year, because through the first 8 games in the season, you could argue he's going to be a top 5 fantasy back. And by the time Kareem Hunt comes along, you'll have a better idea about the running back landscape, and you might have a handful of running back starters. Chubb basically comes down to how much you think Hunt will matter in that offense. To me, if Hunt wasn't involved at all, I think Nick Chubb would be a first-round pick in fantasy. But the ADP right now reflects Kareem Hunt enough to where I would still be fine drafting him. This next question is from @jomo724. If I have the 104 in Dynasty, should I grab Kyler Murray and forego the best available running back or wide receiver? I currently have Mariota and Cousins in my one quarterback, 4-point passing touchdown league. Go for the home run chance? No, you don't want to take a quarterback that early in a single quarterback Dynasty league. And in actuality, taking someone like Murray is the opposite of going for a home run, considering how little of an edge you can get from quarterbacks in fantasy football. And it has nothing to do with Murray. I love Kyler Murray, and I think that he's the QB1 in this class by far. It's just that you're far better off taking a running back or wide receiver given the edge that they can potentially provide week in and week out. That, in Murray's ADP, is a lot lower than where you'd be getting him there. So unless it's a super flex league, you shouldn't be spending first rounders on quarterbacks. The position just is not valuable in fantasy football, and that includes Dynasty. This next question is from @FFAidenMcGrath. How do you decide when to incorporate new information into your prospect models as opposed to keeping them consistent from year to year? Similarly, how do you decide to stop utilizing data you once thought was valuable? So once things are sort of set up and you feel good about your model, not a lot's going to change in one season. But each offseason, I do test data. I incorporate new data points to see if they make the model more accurate by testing the results. Because each year, more and different data does come out usually. Or I just figure out a way to manipulate data differently. So I try and see if that data is more important. Usually it's not. Usually my model just remains the same. Now, as for the second question of when you decide to stop utilizing data that was once thought as valuable, it's really just if you find data that's better through testing. If you find a data point that makes your model better, and you can throw out the other data point without changing the accuracy, then that data point no longer matters. Honestly, that's really it. This next question is from @DavisMatic. In early best balls with quarterback uncertainty, are you okay taking at least one quarterback in the single-digit rounds? Yeah, and I think that you should be okay with doing this regardless to differentiate. I do think there's just as much uncertainty at other positions, but the difference is obviously that there are loads and loads of wide receivers and running backs out there, whereas there is only 32 quarterback starters. So making sure you get at least two of those who are going to have a job throughout the season, that's important. I think it also depends on how the start of your draft is going. I'm going to be more inclined to make a higher selection at quarterback if there seems to be a safe foundation at running back and wide receiver, because obviously there's a higher opportunity cost in getting that earlier round quarterback. So if I'm not safe at those other positions, then I'm going to feel even worse about them if a single-digit round pick is being spent on a quarterback. But yes, overall, I think this logic makes sense. Not only because of uncertainty, but you're able to differentiate across your teams as well. Considering how rare it is for quarterbacks to give you an edge, you shouldn't strive to have all your eggs in one quarterback's basket. This next question is from @FFTylerO. A few players you really like in redraft but won't likely draft due to price. I think you've got to basically look at the early rounds here because it's impossible to not like every player in the early rounds. They're being drafted early for a reason. But Le'Veon Bell is probably one of them. My projections don't love Le'Veon Bell, and I'm nervous about the offense in general. It absolutely has a chance to take a step forward this year, but that doesn't mean the situation for Bell is safe. Like, I would 100% be taking Melvin Gordon over Le'Veon Bell, and I'd probably be cool taking at least David Johnson over him too. I'm also a little bit nervous about Sony Michel. Now, I like Sony Michel a lot, but I'm scared of how he'll be used as a receiver, and his ADP is very high. I wish it was like a half round later to feel more comfortable. And then there's Amari Cooper. The top 30 or so wide receivers are pretty competitive. It's pretty deep. And Cooper's currently a high-end wide receiver too. He's almost a wide receiver one. It's a run-first offense, and Cooper has some negative regression that's going to be hitting in the touchdown column. Now, he's great. I love him as a player, and I wish he was on my fantasy team, but I'd rather draft Stephon Diggs or even AJ Green. So I like all three of those players. I just think they're a little bit overvalued right now. This last question comes from a guy that you might have heard of before. It's from @MatthewBerryTMR. He says, did I win our AAF fantasy league with an 8-0 record or no playoffs, no title? Please discuss for 10 minutes at least. Hashtag Apollos for life. So we've all been in leagues where there's a fluky undefeated team or a team that's like 13-1 at the end of the season, but third in points scored or something. Not in the AAF Analyst League. My team started to turn the corner and was competitive in the end, but guys, Matthew Berry's team legit had like 2 times the amount of points as the second place team after 8 games. It wasn't even close. So if the 8-0 record came with a point total that was just a little bit better than the second place team, I think that we would have an argument. But considering this team was basically the New England Patriots versus the rest of the AFC East, we can safely crown Matthew Berry as the AAF League champion. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to all of you guys for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you're on iTunes, please do me a favor and leave a rating and review. It goes a really long way. I'm also on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.